This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 362 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Rebecca. Stay tuned to the end of the show to find out what a co-producer... This is Sean Connery. Stay tuned to the end of the show and...
Oh, he's dead.
Oh, sorry. Maybe this needs to stay in, because that's true and sad, but that was funny the way that you did it. So... yes. Okay. I'll leave that in. Stay tuned to the end of the show. Now that's my way.
Don't hurt yourself.
Where are we?
He's probably dead too.
I think he is because they didn't have him in that rewatch thing at the table read.
He definitely did not do it in the reboot. No.
So anyway, stay tuned to the end of the show where I will let you know more about what a co-producer is and how you can find out more about becoming one if you'd like.
And now on to our read-along.
This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapter 30, entitled The Captive.
So pretty, I mean, again, I had read more than once before, but, you know, I don't memorize, my default is not to memorize chapter titles. However, and when I got to this one and I was like, oh, The Captive, it didn't hit me over the head with a 2x4 right away, who the captive, who that meant or what it meant. Obviously, really, really quickly it does in the chapter. And yeah, so that's not a secret. Anyway, the captive is Lionel Brown. So Claire is home, safe on the
ridge. You
know
what, though? That chapter had multiple levels to it. To me, I know that Lionel Brown was there. It's more than that, because then they were talking about Lionel Brown, talking about how what they've been doing and how the Committee of Safety was in cahoots with these people and they were selling people to the Indians.
So you're right. It absolutely is more than one type of captive, like a literal and figurative. So it's more than one type and more than one person or whatever. Yes. Superficially, obviously, the surface level is easy to see Lionel. As soon as you said what you said or started to say what you said, I thought, well, duh, Claire is too, right? Because she feels maybe not trapped in her home.
She's totally trapped in her house right now. She's trapped by circumstances.
But no one is holding a gun to her head saying you cannot leave.
No, she is. She's holding one to her head because even though she thought about going to check on Marsley, who was with the McGillivrays,
yeah,
she decided not to because the second she goes and starts visiting, everyone's going to come to her house. And so this moment of quiet she's been able to capture for herself to try to take stock and have autonomy is going to be gone. So she is, in fact, a captive of her own making.
She is a captive. She's definitely a captive. And I would agree that she is the one who is kind of in charge of her captivity. But I would also say, well, and thought of this again because it's used at least twice in the chapter, and that is her soap bubble. So it's not necessarily a soap bubble of captivity. The soap bubble that she and Diana refer to is more like this peace, this bubble of peace, right? This bubble of comfort, this bubble of safety. It exists, but it's also as temporary and as breakable
and fragile
that's a better word as a soap bubble. And so over the next few chapters we'll see more about that soap bubble and why that is. And it's definitely introduced in this chapter. So Claire is home. This is the day after, I believe we're led to believe that she's rescued, brought home, and she and Jamie do the nasty with with penicillin. They're on the ridge and she is recovering. And she notes that Mrs. Bug hadn't come that morning and is pretty sure that that was most likely on Jamie's orders because Mrs. Bug cannot. Yes, she's a gossip, but in this case, she is also, in the case of Claire and Claire's family, she is also very much that motherly figure as far as I'm going to like.
And she. And their housekeeper.
She's their well, yeah, that's true. She is their housekeeper, too. But she's so she already cares for them. Right. She has been caring for them since she and Arch came to the ridge. But yeah, she's definitely she's in their business, obviously, but she cares for them. She cleans for them. She cooks for them. She watches over the chickens. I mean, she is definitely she is a busybody. She's absolutely a gossip, but her heart is gold and she definitely would do anything she could to care for Claire, especially in this condition. So it absolutely would have been said. Something must have been said by Jamie. So she starts to make herself some coffee. Now, Ian was sitting on the back porch. She hadn't known he was there. And she's making coffee. She got some water ready. She was rinsing out the cup and she was about to just dump the hot water out on the porch or outside. And she saw Ian and he startled her and he almost got a face of hot water. But thankfully she caught herself before she did that. And she realizes that he had been set to guard her, or at least that's what it seems to be at first. He looks into her swollen, battered face and says, "You'll do, Auntie. It's still you, isn't it?" And that is what sets her into tears. Quote, "I felt as though my center had turned unexpectedly to liquid and was gushing out, not from grief, but from relief." Unquote. So I think it's very interesting. Yes, she was frustrated. I'm talking post-rescue, not during the captivity, or not during the abduction and captivity. But post-rescue, once she knows that she's no longer in the danger she was, she's rescued there with Jamie and the men. And up till that point, we're thinking as readers that everyone except for Brown has been killed, right? So as far as you can make someone safe, she was as safe as it was going to be at that moment. Everyone's dead, so everyone thinks, and she's being kept there safe. People are guarding the house, or at least one person is guarding the house. So we're guarding her. So ever since she's been back in this situation, back on the ridge, it's not from her feelings, her fear, her emotions. Although surely she has and will continue to have grief, but right now when she starts to release emotionally, it is not from grief. It is not from sadness or from fear. It is from relief. She's like, because the first thing I don't think you can have grief until you. No, that's not true. Oh. That was gonna be a weird thing to say. I was about to say I don't think you can have grief or fully experience or release emotion related to grief until you have relief. But they are definitely separate things. And I'm not speaking in general in anyone's life because like if you lose a child, right? There is never relief. There's never relief with that. The only relief I could think of is maybe if it was like a long illness, maybe, and that they're no longer suffering. But outside of that, like not all death comes with relief, right? But much death comes with grief. For those who are left. So I just wanted to make clear I wasn't saying that you can't grieve something before you're relieved of something else. No. But here for Claire, although she's not Mrs. Bug, she is in a way one of the larger caretakers on the ridge, right? She's the surgeon. She's the medicine woman. She does care. So she is also, maybe not as much as Jamie, but she is also rather stoic when it comes to things, because she has had to be a doctor. She has had to, hold it in. She was a woman in a man's field. So she's in the war, in med school. That's her norm. Like, that's her default, is to keep it together, Beecham, that kind of thing. So not only is that her background, she's here and she still hasn't had a chance. She felt the frustration the night before, right? Because she had her speech, like, "I've been in a bloody war," and all this stuff, and those men's little appendages, like those kind of things. She has that the speech of frustration, and she was crying out of frustration. She absolutely had fear, but she we haven't seen her, I don't think, have grief yet, right? Grief or mourning what was lost, the frustration. Well, I guess it was probably tied up into that speech and into her reaction from that. But it's moved so quickly. They did the thing, again, to give her doubt, to give them both doubt in case she were pregnant. They did that, which was, you know, certainly going to be shocking. Certainly no survivor of sexual assault would ever, you know, think of, let's do this. So that definitely...
Yeah, I don't think that's a method people do nowadays.
Nowadays, I don't think it's any days, but
I don't. I mean, I'm just thinking. I was like, I can't imagine having this horrible trauma happen to you, and having your doctor say, you know what, we gave you the morning after pill, but you should probably go home and have sex with your husband.
Meanwhile, I'm going to give you both shots in the ass.
Right. Good so, Lord.
Yes, she was. She experienced the whole, you know, gamut of. Fear. I mean, got everything during from the abduction and captivity and then rescue. There was definitely, of course, to some degree, relief. But when Ian asks her, you'll do Auntie, it's still you, isn't it? She realizes that even though she's been raped, even though she's been beaten, even though she's been all of this stuff and, you know, the stuff in her life before, but specifically right now, this event, she realizes she still is herself. And from that, she is what Diana is writing about, right? So I felt as though my center had turned unexpectedly to liquid and was gushing out from relief. So Ian seems to understand this. He says, quote, it's a bit strange, coming back. Of course, he's referring to the two times he'd come back from captivity, once from Galus Duncan's Rose Hall in Jamaica, where he was literally a captive, he was abducted, and the other from his own chosen exile with the Mohawk. So he had come back two different times, and both times he had been changed, right, in different ways. So Jamie and Ian, I think, are good characters who could understand a sexual assault, right? As far as being able to empathize with her and absolutely, you know, be good people for her to be around. They love her. They want to care for her. They do care for her. They will protect her up till death, right? But they've also got this experience. So they have a unique sense of what she's been through. It was different. They're all different. And something I've said a few times or typed a few times in a few places on social media, I think, because I've seen this and a lot of times, and this is absolutely not what's happening here in the book, but a lot of times I've noticed, and maybe I've already said this, but a lot of times I've noticed when there's a conversation or someone's talking about, like, say, okay, this is what happened to me. And then someone goes, oh yeah, well, this happened to me. And there's kind of two ways it can go, right? There's two ways those conversations can go. It can almost seem that if someone is sharing something, like, I understand wanting to share and kind of commiserate, like, I get it. We're humans. We want to, especially if it's a bad situation and you don't know anyone around you or in your community who has survived something like that. So I can see it being absolutely helpful to chat with someone or to hear from someone who's been through who's been through something similar, so that you can see, you know, that number one, you're not alone. Number two, you can get through it. You can get through it with help, support, all those kind of things. So I understand, like, that is kind of one way it can go, right? Where the sharing of experiences can help maybe even both sides continue to get through trauma or continue to heal. But I have seen so many times where it goes the other direction. Now, I'm not talking like intimate details or anything, but I've seen where it's almost like a one-upmanship. Well, I had this happen to me. Oh, well, at least you didn't have blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, something popped in my head months ago. And this is why for me, months ago, and I'm not saying I'm the first person ever in the history of the world to say this, but I may have said it on our show once. If I did, it was in the last few episodes. I see so much, and even one time is too much. So, and I try to check myself too. I have, you know, by the grace of God, not had these types of experiences. You know, thank goodness. So I'm definitely not able to speak to anything like this. However, whenever it doesn't have to be a sexual assault to have this kind of one-upmanship, right? If someone loses their dad and you have, you know, oh, this and this, and then, and someone else says, well, at least you still have your mom, or, you know, at least your dad died from this and he didn't have to go through that. And I'm like, whoa, shut the front door. You shut your lips right now. The only appropriate response is, I'm so sorry for your loss. Period.
Did you just say shut your website down?
No. I think I said shut your mouth.
Shut your website down.
If you have a website that is spewing this, then shut your website down. Okay, that's the name of this episode. That's the name of this episode. Okay, my point is,
it won't be. It never is.
You stop it. I'm going to do it just to spite you now.
It never is.
Stop it. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Shut your website down.
My point is, it doesn't have to be about sexual assault. It can be anything. It can be your kid having a problem at school. It doesn't matter. There are two ways that I see. Maybe there are more. I typically see things. Not there. Gray is everywhere. I'm not saying gray doesn't exist. More people have to understand and know that we actually life is in the gray. It's there. It's not black and white. However, my brain in this situation sees those kinds of conversations go two ways. They go, if someone does share, it can be mutually assistive, supportive, empathetic. If they share, and you don't have to share. That's kind of my main point. You don't have to share. But I see too often it goes the other way. And what that has made me, the phrase that turned in my brain, like cranked it out, or, you know, kind of like worked on this, not a problem, but like was trying to masticate on this thing. And that's what came to my brain. I said, there is no competition in trauma. There is no competition in trauma. There is no competition in trauma. And trauma is not a competition. So the moment it becomes one, or appears to become one, or being treated like one, is the moment your involvement in that conversation has begun to center yourself. You have begun to center yourself. If someone is talking about trauma or something mentions someone, like say, and this is not, it's related to the chapter, but it does not happen in the chapter. To me, I have never heard that phrase until I came up with it, but I'm not saying I'm the first one to ever say that. But yeah.
Did you just say I haven't heard that phrase until I came up with it?
Yes. What I'm trying to say is I'm not saying I'm the only person in the world who has ever said that. I'm saying I had never heard that phrase before I came up with it. Is that better? But I heard myself talking about it, so yes, I heard it. So anyway, all that to say, yes, comma is not a trompetition.
Uh-uh.
This is full of great stuff.
Don't
people.
Hurt yourself.
Apparently I have. So, yes, that's what I was getting to when I was talking about Ian's trauma and Claire's, at least this specific trauma. So yeah, trauma is not a competition. And I think too often in today's day and age, people, and I think, and again, here I like armchair psychologist, which I am definitely not. I'm thinking like, why do people do that? Not just center themselves, but why do they feel the need to, even if it's not their goal, to compare and show that I've had it worse, right? Intrinsically, what motivates that?
We call those one-uppers.
But what motivates that? Why does someone feel
know.
That?
I think... Narcissism. Why is anybody? People have to feel like, I think these people, everything has to relate back to them. Like, and these are the same people who literally listen to your conversation and wait for you to stop talking so that they can talk about themselves. Like, they're listening to what you're saying only as deeply as how they can come up with something to say that's just as important or better than what you just said. I can't tell you why.
A thought on why people might. Now, I am not saying... narcissists aren't out there. Of course they are. I don't think 30 to 50% of the population or more are narcissists. Can they be narcissistic? Absolutely. But so that absolutely can be a factor. But what I see,
humans needing to connect.
And that's more along the lines of what I was thinking. So while it can be a connection,
I think it's mostly narcissists, but I think it's connection.
The thought that I had was, you know, why would people do that? Even if it's not their intent, right? To center themselves, to compete, because trauma is not a competition. The thing that made the most sense is, yes, I think it's a drive. I think you said it, Summer. I think it's a drive to connect, but not just connect, but to be feel. to feel listened to. Even if you're just talking, right? If you haven't had, and this doesn't mean it's for everyone or to everyone or everyone does this, but someone who treats, even without meaning to, a discussion or conversation about trauma and does a one up and makes it into a kind of a verbal competition, I don't believe at the heart of every person who does that, that it's someone who is narcissistic or even, you know, is trying to center themselves, trying to make it about themselves. I truly think you're right. I think it's about connection. But the reason I think it's about connection, or I think connection can be part of it, but I really think it's maybe a misguided attempt to get a connection, right? They're just doing it in maybe not the best way at that moment. But I also think that these people also want to be listened to. But they just don't realize that that moment is not the moment to try to be listened to, because that moment was started or begun, that place, it was started, right, by someone else discussing their trauma. And so because trauma is not a competition, it's not the time to compete. I do think if you enter someone else's space who is discussing their trauma, I don't think it's inappropriate to mention your trauma. But it has to be done. As I said, those conversations I see, black and white wise, can go two ways. It can be a competition or it can be a sharing and a connection, but mostly as a moment of support. Because it's not, again, it's not about you. In that moment, it's not about you. So, but if you share something in a supportive manner, you can continue to keep it about the other person, and then your sharing becomes supportive, and then it becomes kind of a mutual thing rather than separating it and making it a competition. So anyway, yeah. And I've got I've gotten through one line of notes.
Oh God, I thought you said this wasn't going to be as long as the last one.
No, nothing like that. So that set her.
We'll see about that.
So Ian seems to, I already talked about that. Hold on. No, okay. I've gotten through about five lines. So Ian makes her breakfast. Claire says something that I don't think I ever noticed before. She says, and I already mentioned this in my ramblings, but I don't, before reading it this time through, I don't remember the analogy. She says, quote, "It's rather like sitting on a soap bubble though, isn't it?" Unquote. And as we already spoke about the soap bubble, but yeah, it's feeling supported. You could even say like being inside the soap bubble, right? So whether you're sitting on one or being inside of one, whatever it is, anything involving a soap bubble cannot be forever and is very tenuous and the most momentary thing you can kind of have. Although it's beautiful and it's light and floaty and glistening and all those things, but it's so temporary, it's almost sad. So she doesn't want to think about the night before. So thankfully, us readers are spared a bit more because we got enough last chapter. Ian, though, seems to be the only one there with her, and she's okay with that. Ian says that his uncle means to ask questions that morning. Of course, questions of Lionel Brown. But then before she can say, what? Fergus arrives. She asks him about Marsali and the kids. And it seems that our wee Germain, even though he had already left, or so we thought, had actually kind of saved the day. He, after the men had come, when he did leave, or he started to leave, and once he saw the men come, he scrambled up a tree, as he does, and he climbed, and he had seen everything. And once the men had gone, he had gotten down and dragged his mom from the fire and run for help. Now, I gotta know, someone has to do the math or know better than I, which is probably everyone. How old was this little boy? Was he like 3 or 4 or 5?
6-year-olds then have way more muscle on them than 6-year-olds now do. They did a lot more stuff. And if he's climbing trees daily, he's got upper body strength. Come on. What else is he climbing? His song is Don't Fall, Don't Fall.
That's true. I think, is Fergus. He joins them for some breakfast, and Claire decides that later she will go visit Marsali. She also asks about Mrs. Bug, and she finds out, Mrs. Bug is minding the captive. So Lionel Brown was still alive.
I have a question for you. because you just kind of glossed over breakfast, and I never do that. They're eating. They sit down to eat breakfast, and this is the person I'm. It's the cooking, baking, preparing kitchen person that I am. He pulls out just all this random stuff from the pantry or whatever, the larder or whatever. And so there's just this random amalgam of things. And Claire's choice for breakfast was 3 to 4 day old porridge that she just decided was, I think it's okay. I think if anything I learned from this chapter is that if Claire, the healer, says that we can eat 3 day old porridge that's been sitting out, then it's probably safe to eat 3 day old porridge that's been sitting out. I've never thought of eating 1 day old oatmeal or 3 hour old oatmeal, but apparently you can. Is it safe? Would you have to reheat it? Like she did, and it seemed like she ate it cold. Like she didn't talk about reheating it. Like she just put it in a bowl and it.
I have questions. Maybe. Well, I don't know about the age of it. Like I mean, I believe what you say. I don't know.
Well, she very specifically said it's not like it was 9 days old. She goes, but it had been 3 or 4 days since someone had been there.
So yeah, it probably had a few little microorganisms in it. I mean, but she has penicillin there.
Is she hoping for some extra penicillin in there?
I don't know. Maybe so. That's funny. So Claire learns that Lionel Brown is still alive and he's there somewhere on the ridge. Claire thinks that, or the healer in her thinks that, you know, she's like, oh, maybe I should go see him to look at his wounds and everything. And they tell her, no, you shouldn't. Ian says this, quote, with an air of authority I wasn't accustomed to seeing in him, unquote. Jamie had said she was to be kept there, or at least that she shouldn't see him. And of course, everyone listens to Jamie over her. Of course. Now, she has a hard time believing this. She's like, she can't believe this. And the two men, no one's looking at her. No one will make eye contact with her. All Ian will say is that they meant to question him. And once Jamie is satisfied with whatever answers he can get out of him, well, and then I also missed this on previous readings. Ian splits open his sausage with the knife and then makes direct eye contact with Claire. Yep, auntie, that's what we plan to do with him. Or at least Ian would like to, Mohawk that he is. Had you missed that in your previous read?
I didn't remember him slicing sausage at all.
Okay.
That was not the breakfast. That was the breakfast I glossed
Summer's
over.
Like, no, I was too wrapped up in the food.
I'm like, porridge, 3 day old porridge.
Side note, as I said, I did not remember the sausage thing. The sausage thing. Quote, he looked up then, met my eyes directly. And I realized that while I might still be me, Ian was no longer the boy he used to be. Not at all. Unquote. So that's a happy meaning there.
You think? Is it?
Obviously. Come on. Not festively happy.
I'm like, I mean, he's to my knowledge, he's never had to chop sausages. All of his captors have been sausage-less.
Summer. Okay.
Ginger.
I'm not talking about a penis.
Talked about slicing a sausage and then looking directly into Claire's eyes. I'm like.
Yes, because that's what he was eating. That's what he was eating.
Right. But
he was implying that was Lionel. He was not talking about Lionel's penis.
Are you sure? Because you said sausage and cutting it, and it was very Bobbitt.
Sure.
It was very Bobbitt-esque the way you were describing it.
Okay. So Fergus confirms that, yep, they planned to kill him.
He sliced a sausage and he looked right in her eyes. What did you want me to think?
That he was making a threat against Lionel, not about Lionel's penis.
Yeah, but it was a very specific food item that he was cutting through while making eye contact with her.
That's on Diana. That's not on me. That's on Diana. He was eating a sausage.
But what did you want me to think?
It doesn't really make the same point if you're trying to chop eggs.
I mean, it could have. It would have made a different point for sure.
She stammers out that he hadn't, he was not one of the dudes, and everyone knows what they mean, what she means. He hadn't been one of the ones to rape her. He'd broken his leg before she'd even been raped. And he hadn't been one of the ones who attacked Marsali. Quote, something behind Ian's eyes changed as he grasped my meaning. His lips pressed tight for a moment, and he nodded. And then, quote, "As well for him then," Ian said. So even though she just answered the biggest question Jamie was likely to have, not the only one, there was a lot, but one of the biggest ones, it didn't matter. It was better for him that he hadn't been one of the rapists, but still.
Not really.
Sausage time.
Like, she mentions that, oh, well, he didn't do these things to me directly, but then he did try to kill me several times and try to get other people to kill me. And then he wanted to drown me. And if he hadn't broken his leg, there's a possibility.
I doubt he would have gone and raped. I mean, who knows? We didn't get that story. But he, I think, would he have tried to kill her? He did, absolutely. I don't think he would have gone as far as trying to rape her, though. But who knows? Who knows? Fergus confirms, quote, "As well, but I think it will not matter in the end. We killed the others. Why should he live?" Unquote. And that's that. So then they both leave. Now, she knows Lionel was nefarious, that he had tried to talk Hodgepile out of taking her and out of hurting her. But then she knows he would have absolutely drowned her. She didn't mind if he died, but she felt uneasy about it. She did mind Ian and Fergus being part of it and Jamie. Battle killing, we're reminded, is different from execution, and Jamie, at least, certainly knew this.
Well, but that's like anything. It's like the difference between a murder of passion and premeditated murder. You know what I mean? It's
tell me about this.
Tell me about that? There's the really?
Yeah. Tell me about your experience.
I don't have experience. This is not a shared experience moment, Ginger.
Okay,
this
good.
This is about me speaking to the different levels of murder, just like, you know, there's accidental death, there is crimes of passion or things that happen in the heat of the moment, and then there is like cold, thought out, methodical, I have a plan for this, I executed my plan, and now this person is dead. Like, and I know there's a lot of other places in between all of those those points I made. However, it's the same here. It's like killing in the course of a battle where everyone's killing everyone is different than standing a dude up and shooting him, or having some guy tied to a table because he's got two broken legs and then assassinating him, or not assassinating him, but just killing him. There's a difference because there's no, he is not a threat. He is currently physically not a threat to them. So killing an unarmed, a non-threatening, got two broken-legged man.
Injured man.
Yeah. It does not have the same amount of valor or honor as the other types, that as the rest of the men who were killed. That's all, I think, is where he was going with that.
She thinks of how it's only 2 years from the shot heard around the world. And okay, just so you, so I'm, well, I'm not judging Claire for this, obviously, but there are a few things that people call shots heard around the world. The one that I believe, unless you're a historian and that is your area of expertise, which I am not, and that is not, when I hear shot heard around the world, I think of July 28th, 1914, I believe, it was the day before. July 28th, 1914 is either the day that Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He was the heir to Franz Josef because Rudolf killed himself. So yeah, it did involve Franz Josef. Franz Josef was the one who declared war on, I think, Bosnia or Serbia, maybe both. Anyway, so yes, his heir, his second heir now, was dead. And that is, so that bullet that killed that heir is what is, I think, most modern people learn to, that it is called the shot heard around the world because it led to World War One, or what became World War One. And Claire, certainly having lived through World War II and then gone back and lived through the 60s, she certainly knows this. Now, I don't know if in her time it was called that, but in the 18th century, in that history, yes. So that is referring to the battles of Lexington and Concord specifically. So that's when the Revolutionary War starts.
Okay, but here's another thing. I just looked on, I Wikipedia'd this and I typed shot heard around the world. And it says, the shot heard round
there's
the world
be more.
Is a phrase that refers to the opening shot of the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19th, 1775. Wikipedia is siding with Diana Gabaldon right now.
Oh, it's not, again, trauma is not a competition. Neither are phrases like this. I'm just saying, I think, and I think there are more things that are that can be referred to as shots heard around the world, right? Jamie, remember, who'd been working on the roof, you may don't remember because I didn't mention it yet, but that's what Ian says. He's working on the roof and he bellows out a roar.
Yeah. And immediately, as if on cue, like he was waiting for Ian to say he's working on the roof, the hammering on the roof starts.
Yes, exactly. And so he has a splinter.
So is Jamie sitting up there waiting for the cue?
Oh, Summer, that I don't know. Has a splinter from one of the shingles or from some wood. And he comes down so she can fix him. And I mean, it was a splinter, but it was like two inches long and driven under his nail. No, thank you. Like that is that's a bit much. That's gross. Not just gross. I mean, that's painful. I cannot imagine that. She, while she's there doctoring him, she confronts him about the brown thing. And he's like, yeah, I mean to question him. No, he hasn't asked Roger to be part of it yet. Quote, Roger Mack's a good fighter, but not the sort to scare a man, save he's truly roused. He's no deceit in him at all, unquote. Oh, Lord, poor Roger. I mean, he's not wrong, but poor Roger. Jamie was trying to change the subject, though. But Claire's like, will you kill him? And Jamie says, I think so. Not today, but if I do it, it'll be done properly. And I wrote, what does that even mean? He explains a little bit later. But yeah, what this means to Jamie is it would be done in the open before witnesses who know the truth of what happened, and Bram would be standing up. So it definitely would be after he healed to whatever degree he could. Claire snatches onto the small possibility of what he left out. He might let him live, but he doesn't know. They talk about where they might take Brown to hand him over to authorities. And it's just the possibilities are really not that great. There is no local sheriff. Their backcountry area has not been incorporated anywhere into a county yet. And they certainly wouldn't take him to the nearest county's sheriff because that dude, Brownsville, was in that county and the dude was a Brown. Maybe to Cross Creek. They had a lot of connections there. Maybe even to Hillsborough. But this... the whole taking him anywhere would take weeks to accomplish, and it had its own dangers. So Jamie asks her, what of the others? And this is what Jamie is, I think, going at. And this is part of the bigger conversation. Yes, Lionel Brown is something right there in their face that they had to take care of, however it comes about. But the larger conversation that, at least myself, even though I know what happened, In the book, in the previous chapters, in this chapter, in this conversation, in this narrative, I wasn't thinking about these people because we're meant to focus on Claire and the people surrounding her, and then Brown, right? The guy who's the captive, the guy they have, the only guy who supposedly survived from this thing. Remember, half of the people, we don't know the exact number, before Hodgepile. Was it before or after they crossed the gorge? Was it before?
Say that again.
So Jamie asks her, what of the others? There's so much in this. It's others what? Others who? Maybe people who got away? No. The ones who split from the group who were supposed to arrive in Brownsville about now, a few days later. So when they split, right? So there was the group of people, however many there were, who approached the malting shed, right? At some point, mm-hmm. they split. Claire was taken with Hodgepile and Lionel Brown and that part of the gang. And the other part of the gang was they were to reconnoiter in Brownsville in a few days' time. Did they split before or after? Do you remember? Before or after they crossed the gorge?
Probably before. I don't recall.
Okay. I don't recall either. I was just curious.
I, like Claire, do not recall.
That's funny. So...
because I feel like they would have split long before the gorge.
I think you're right. So they split at some point, and this the other half was supposed to, they were all going to meet together in Brownsville. Hodgepile hoped to bring whiskey along with them, right? Because that was the whole reason to keep only reason to keep Claire alive. Although at first, later on, maybe definitely for his own survival as a hostage. But anyway, so somewhere out there. Near Brownsville, those people were supposed to be arriving any day now, any time now. Someone would know soon that shiz had gone down. And Jamie wasn't willing to risk leaving the ridge to take Lionel anywhere as long as there were a chance that these others might try to come get Claire or try to, you know, burn them down or try to come attack the ridge in whatever capacity. She might be able to identify them. And so there's that. And so there's, it's not just how do we deal with Lionel, right? I mean, not even of the keep alive, kill kind of thing, but or keep alive, kill, or take to some higher authority, which would obviously be the ideal thing. The problem is if they do that, not only would it take a lot of time, it would take weeks. It would then, unless she were with him.
Well, the closest place is a Brown.
Yeah, but they wouldn't go there. But even if Jamie took her with him, she's still, you know, battered, bruised, and healing, literally. But even if she were to go with them, and she were protected by Jamie because they were traveling together, you're leaving the ridge and its inhabitants without. Well, even if they left, because they would have to take, Jamie would have to take more than just him. He would need to take a few hands with him, not just himself, because he would need someone to help him with Brown. He would need some people to watch Claire when he couldn't be around her. So it would be much more than just Jamie. So if Jamie and Ian and Fergus and whomever went a party to take Brown elsewhere, you're leaving the ridge not unprotected because you would leave someone there to hopefully protect it. But my point is you're now splitting your strengths, right? You're not home where you have your things.
You're announcing to anyone you come across that it's unprotected. Now is the time. Yeah.
Like I said, there are chances that Claire might be able to recognize or identify some of these people. And then as all this is going through her mind, she realizes she has to tell Jamie something. Oopsie. She tells him about Donner. And not only that, there's this new TT guy around in town somewhere nearby. Also, that she hadn't remembered seeing him among the dead. So, side note, if she didn't see him dead, isn't there a possibility that others of Hodgepyle's band could have gotten away too? If one did, then absolutely, like not, you know, not 10 of them, but if one did, absolutely another could have. Just keep, file that somewhere away in the back of your mind and don't worry about it, but we may or may not revisit that. But, so she's telling Donner. She's telling Jamie about Donner. And the main point is that there's another time traveler about, right? And she tells Jamie that she had warned him, like, look, my husband's going to be here with people. He's going to kill you. You need to get out of here. If you want to save yourself, leave. Although she wanted to go with him, but he didn't, obviously.
You've chosen poorly.
But she couldn't swear, even though I just said, because I took notes on what she wrote or what Diana wrote, what Claire was thinking. She says she didn't remember seeing Donna among the dead. And that's true. But on more reflection, she couldn't swear Donna was dead or alive, because Jamie asks her, I believe Jamie asks her, and she responds that yes, she remembers him walking her around so that she would see they were dead, so that she would remember and not have, you know, too much more fear than she needed to have already. She could be sure that they were gone and could never come back and hurt her. However, in these paragraphs, she also says to Jamie, all I could see was you. So she couldn't swear anyone was dead or alive. I mean, Hodgepyle, sure. She saw that.
But she said that, but he said the same thing.
Yes.
He said the same thing. He only looked at her. Oh. So he's not a good witness either, because he couldn't tell her if there was someone that looked like him among the dead.
Okay. So, wow, they're both bad witnesses. That's interesting. I was so thinking about Claire, I didn't even notice that Jamie had said that. So if he did run, where would he go? Meaning Donner. And Jamie says, likely to Brownsville. And if so, then Richard Brown already knows what happened and likely thinks his brother is dead too. Maybe so. So Jamie had told Ian it was best that Claire didn't see Lionel because of her oath, right? Could she see an injured man and not work to heal him? And then would it put her in an awkward place if she healed him knowing that their most likely intention was to have him executed?
Though that would be an excellent torture technique.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
I'm just saying, heal him just enough and then torture him some more.
Oh my gosh, Summer.
Think of how mentally that would screw with a dude. Like,
of
so
course
you have
it would.
Big bad whatever come in and do all the torture, and then you have the woman come in afterwards and she's like, oh, let me heal you. you're okay. We'll get you through this, blah, blah, blah. And then the next day after he's healed a little bit, somebody comes in and does it all over again. That would screw with you, man.
Absolutely. Jamie doesn't understand why she'd wish to care for him. And she says she's glad the others are dead. And she feels ashamed that she's glad that they're dead. She thinks if she saw him, meaning Lionel, and helped him, it might help her to make amends for being glad they were dead. So talk about a mind F.
I don't suppose that'll work.
No, maybe not. What I'm about to say, I know just by prefacing it is like putting it out there as far as, you know, putting a big red flashing light around it. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but this is important. She grapples with the fact that they may not be safe on the ridge ever again.
Or did it just highlight to them that they were never safe on the ridge?
Hey, bingo, ding, ding, I think we have a winner. But there's not ever really being safe, truly, because, you know, out in the elements, all of this, you could starve at any time, you know, your crops could fail, all that. There's knowing the natural world, right? Knowing that that may fail to sustain you, or something may happen, you may fail a crop or whatever. There's knowing the natural risks, which is nature, the environment, which, and also means, you know, roving vagabonds, right? It can be dangerous people all the time. So there's knowing that. That is not new to them. I don't think that's why they do so much to protect themselves as they can. But people, I mean, it is Jamie, so you never know. There could always be that as a target. But after this happens, not only does it confirm, yeah, you're in danger, and yeah, you were never really not in danger, right, on the ridge, but they can put a face and a name, potential face and name, to people who would be a danger. So when you don't know people specifically have it out, or when you cannot name people, or let alone a group or a town, who would have it out for you by name, by face, it's a lot more comfort. It's not easier to comfort yourself, right? That, yeah, we probably never were really all that safe, but it was by unknown intruders or unknown arsonists, or, you know, there's because we know there's that whole thing about some house burning down, right? That we learned about in book five. No, sorry, four. So that hasn't happened. So is there an arsonist? We don't know yet. And so, yeah, I think Summer's 100% correct. They were never that safe, but they had the safety blanket, if you will. They had the soap bubble, if you will, of a layer of maybe false protection that maybe it wasn't as scary.
A false sense of security, for sure.
Yes. Maybe.
And she has, to date, always felt safer with Jamie there. You know what I mean? So she's always had this sense that nothing bad could happen if they're together. Nothing bad that they couldn't handle would happen while they were together. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So I absolutely think that while they now have a potential face, name, town, whatever, identity of whatever type, to put on these big, bad strangers, or to put on a group or entity that would cause them harm, it is much, absolutely much scarier being able to put a name or a face to something than it is. I mean, okay, there's a lot I could disagree with here, but I mean, in this particular case, right? Yes, Summer, you're right. They were absolutely always in danger of the elements. They were in danger of starving. They were in danger of having, you know, roving bandits coming in and torch their place. That always existed, right? So nothing has changed. Literally, from one day to the next, nothing has changed as far as the potential danger. However, now that danger has a face and a name, potentially, it becomes, I think, more real. And so, yes, it is that much more kind of in your face. And it's no longer potential. It's, number one, she has been injured, right? So you have the literal proof, but now you have this potential, you have this cloud over you now that just makes it that much more real for the future, potentially. So yeah, so she grapples with this, that they may not ever be safe there on the ridge again. There were a lot of people from Hodgepile's group who were now, from the original group at least, who were now likely in Brownsville. And who knew or would soon know that Lionel was captive on the ridge. So at first, the very least, the first thing they would think is that the first level is they find out that something happened. And the second level is everyone was killed and Lionel's nowhere to be found. So the first assumption would be that Lionel was among the dead, which is bad for everyone, or bad for Jamie and them. Well, also bad for the Browns because, again, family, whatever. But the next level is, oh no, he's alive and they took him, which is like, I don't know, in the Browns' eyes, maybe even worse, right? Yes, they didn't kill him, but they kept him, what, to torture him, to do this, to do that? Who knows? So you got a lot of different layers there. And that was the problem that they soon knew or would know, soon would know. So Fergus had told her that Marsali and the kids had gone to stay with the McGillivrays. And Claire's decided, okay, I'll visit her tomorrow. So in her surgery, she contemplates some nightshade berries, which were very poisonous, and they would bring a slow, painful death. And that makes her think of the ether, which could be quick and merciful. So are we thinking what she would do, or are we thinking what Jamie would allow her to do? I think we're thinking of her weapons, right? Those are her weapons, potential weapons.
Well, they're what did we say? They're a women's weapon. Women are more likely to use poison.
Well, historically, that's what I understand to be said.
Yeah. When I say we, I don't mean that you and I coined the phrase. It is.
No. But we also could mean today, meaning in the 21st century. But yes, historically, that is what I understand to have been said, or to have been understood. She decides, okay, I'm going to go read. So there's no one there in the house. As far as she knows, she's alone. She goes into Jamie's study and chooses a book to read. It's Tom Jones. And later that afternoon, Thomas Christie comes to visit.
A different Tom.
A different Tom. That is true. He picks up the book that she dropped in startlement. And he asks if there's no one there to care for her. And should he have his daughter come? And she's like, no, I'll be okay. It'll be fine. And the reason he'd come was to see about his ripped stitches. So this man who has so much, so much aga, which is true, but that's German. This man who has so much enmity with Jamie, right? So much bad blood, just their differences, their histories, right? He had come. No, we don't know. And I don't think we ever get the story, and we don't need it. I think we can all envision it, I think, closely enough to how it probably happened. Once they learned that Claire was taken, they rounded up people, right? And just like, and left. And they probably went around to all the homesteads and said, you know, look, Claire's gone, you know, meet in half an hour or come right away. We need you to go rescue her. Whatever, right? That happened in some capacity.
So you're saying that Jamie didn't run to the giant precipice and light a giant wicker.
That is called Hollywood.
Wicker medieval cross on fire.
That's Hollywood.
To call all of his men. You're saying that's not what happened?
No? Fiery cross had nothing to do with Claire. That's correct. That's just Hollywood.
But that's not what season 5 said.
And we are not talking about season 5, are we now? So Tom had, the reason he'd come was to see about his ripped stitches. How did they rip? How did they get ripped? As he was killing some people on behalf of his landlord's wife.
Well, that is the implication.
Correct. Correct.
He never says.
That's right. But she saw him there.
He never says.
We know he was there.
She did pull all kinds of... She pulled all kinds of debris out of his hand while she was cleaning it. So twigs and bark and pine needles or whatever the hell
no,
she finds in there.
No, we do know. She saw Tom Christie. She saw him at the rescue.
Well, that may very well be, but she did not sound convinced when she said to him, I believe you did this on my behalf. So she didn't say, thank you for fighting to free me.
That's true.
Because I saw you doing it. She said... Thank you for what I believe were injuries incurred upon my behalf. So she didn't see him do anything. She may have seen him there, but she did not see him do anything. So she is even not sure. He could have gotten those things pushing a branch out of the way while walking through the woods on the way. Right?
Oh, Summer.
I don't know.
You gotta give him a little more credit. Hold on. Would he ever do something like this for Jamie? I don't know. So you gotta think about it. Would he do it for Claire? That's all I'm gonna say.
A little bit, apparently. A little bit. A little bit. But he's so touchy. He's so touchy about everything.
I didn't know. Like, this at the very end of this chapter, conversation, like, about Tom Christie's being.
She says, "Well, I'm just saying. Like, he's so touchy. He can't take any even implied criticism on anything.
He can barely take
about
a compliment.
Anything he's done in his life.
He can barely take a compliment.
Thank you. Without his hackles rising and him, like, almost throwing that book back in her face.
Yes.
And the only reason he didn't is because he wanted to read it.
Well, the only reason he didn't is because he had an injured hand. He couldn't, but yes. He wanted to read it too. So she asks, his incision was healing, and she fixes it, and she asks him if he read novels. And he said he hadn't read Tom Jones, the specific book Claire was reading, but he says, my wife, implying that his wife read novels, but he stops. His voice was cold when he spoke of his wife. He didn't approve of the reading of novels, and he burned her books. So what changed his opinion? Well, Jamie had told them the story of Tom Jones while they were in Ardsmuir. Because, of course, Jamie has, like, this masterful, perfect memory, probably photographic. And over time, Tom he had the opinion at some point he formed that fiction might not merely be an inducement to idleness and wicked fancy. It might actually lead one to consider things and change, become a better person. So his eyes were open to that, to allow for that possibility. And he'd found it remarkable. He still thinks it was distraction, but he saw how that could draw men together. Highlanders, Lowlanders, Protestants, Catholics. He saw evidence of that in Ardsmuir. And side note, I love these peaks in Ardsmuir because we don't have a book called Ardsmuir, right? We don't. We only get peaks like this. They talk for hours. Like, what else do they have to do besides, you know, spending 12 hours a day, like, working in cutting peat, and then coming back and after eating or whatever it was, like, sleep, right? You got sleep. Well, they had nothing else to do time, like, activity wise once they were back in their cell.
Once daylight's gone, they're all just hanging out in the dark, freezing. I mean, you've been to Scotland. It's cold. And if they don't let you have fires and nice thick duvets and feather beds, you got to make friends. And what better way to make friends than to huddle around and tell stories?
So while they labored, I was wrong. It wasn't just when they were in their cells. It was while they labored. So while they were out on the fields, they would talk about this character or that character. And so Tom Christie definitely had a change of heart in general when it came to novels. He still probably was suspicious of it, or maybe not, like, you know, if that's all someone did, obviously it would have been a waste of time, according to him. But his mind was changed enough to allow a crack of light in as far as maybe it wasn't all that bad. So she finishes his hand and she says, thank you. And once he grasps what she means, he's taken aback and a bit embarrassed. She offers to lend him.
Exactly.
She offers to lend him the book and he takes it. And she asks, as he's getting ready to go, making conversation, did you ever have a chance to apologize to your wife? He grows cold, says no, and leaves. Though, mind, he takes the book with him. So there's that.
And that was chapter 30. Join us next time when we will be discussing... when we will be continuing our Breath of Stone Ashes read-along with chapters 31, entitled something about going to bed. And so to bed.
Isn't that every chapter?
And that is chapter 31. And chapter 32, entitled Hangings Too Good. And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can join us at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a very special thanks to our co-producer for this episode, Rebecca. To find out more about what a co-producer is and how you might become one, visit patreon.com/outlanderpod.
And with the holidays coming up, if you are looking to purchase something that's maybe Outlander related, maybe tangentially podcast related, but definitely artwork that I made related, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop and check out what we've got to order there. And remember, all proceeds that we earn through the end of the year are going to Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS/the COVID, whatever their COVID
AIDS/the COVID
arm of Broadway Cares. Well, it's not AIDS, but that's the main thing.
That's how it was developed, though.
Ugh, it's so bad. Right. Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS is the big moneymaker that they do every year that saves money. And this is the, yeah, and then this is their COVID arm.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.